everyone, and welcome back to the Strike and Ellicott Files, an unofficial podcast dedicated to all things Cormoran Strike and Robin Ellicott, as written by Robert Galbraith. My name is Kenz.
I'm Lindsay.
And I'm Pools.
And today we'll be continuing our reread of The Running Grave, covering chapters 79 through 82 of part 6. Please be aware, as always, that our discussion of The Running Grave will often reference the ending of this book, as well as the previous books in the series. But before we get into this set of chapters, we had a listener question that we wanted to do, and this one was really fun.
I love this question. This question gives me all the feels.
Yeah, this one was really sweet. This was a question that we received by email from Shannon, and she says, I'm curious to know if there was a moment during your first reading of the books that you remember going from normal fan to crazy obsessed super fan. Were you 100% on board from the beginning of Cuckoo, or was there a specific moment that really stands out for you where you thought, oh, wow, I just became completely hooked on these characters, the series? I remember bolting upright in my bed reading the moment in Career of Evil when Robin is being attacked and Strike grabs the phone from the teenagers to call police. He got both cell phones going, trying to run, trying to find a cab, trying to hear anything from Robin. And while the stunned teenagers ran alongside him like bodyguards, that was my moment. I went from just casually reading and enjoying this nice little British detective series to full-on Nutter territory.
Full-on.
Relatable.
Yeah.
I'm not sure these characters have ever completely left my brain since. So I was wondering if others had a moment, or did you just fall in love gradually?
I have a kind of a long answer to this. I think I've shared parts of it before, but something definitely happened to me during Career of Evil. I felt the feelings during chapter 40 when Strike thinks of his feelings for Robin, and I certainly felt things at the ending. So I had definitely become more invested in them. But also at that time, I had just had my first baby 2 weeks before, and I was recovering physically and emotionally from an unexpected C-section. So while I felt all the things, I was sort of able to set the book and the characters aside when I was done in a way that I have not been able to do since, just because of what was going on personally, right? Leading up to Lethal White, though, when we get into that great wait, you know, that 3 years.
The lethal wait.
The lethal wait. Yeah. I had decided that I wanted to reread the first three books for the first time because I hadn't done that yet. And that experience was great because at this point, I had now been away from my PI job for a few years and I was able to see Strike as a character in such a different light. If you haven't heard me talk about that before, it was kind of hard for me to see him clearly for the first two books because I was judging him by my boss a little bit too much.
Not a great guy.
No. So that reread was when I knew I loved him. Capital L loved him. He was funnier and kinder than I had remembered and so smart. And I remember telling my husband how much I liked him. But then God, Lethal White hit, and that prologue. That prologue has had me in a headlock since 2018. It's never let me go. I guess it all kind of happens in stages because those were the personal ones where I felt like these characters just became part of my soul a little bit. But then leading up to Troubled Blood and into the pandemic is when I found myself reaching out to other people online. And that's a whole other level. So I don't know. I guess it happens in stages, but those are the things that really stand out to me.
Yeah. I think that mine was a similar experience where it happened in the stages because if you haven't listened to our introduction episode, so whenever I was first getting into Strike, I had read Cuckoo's Calling first.
As you should.
Well, I mean, as anybody should. I had bought Silkworm, but hadn't read it. I liked Cuckoo's Calling, but not enough for me to like immediately pick up book two. So there were a few years that went by after I first read. A few years. I think it was like 3 years. It was around the time that this TV series came out. And I watched Cuckoo through Career of Evil. And I was like, oh my God. I was like, wait a second. I got to go back. I got to go read these. So then after I was done with that, I had ordered the other books off of Amazon and they all came in on different dates. So remember, I said I had read Cuckoo first. And then after that, I read Career of Evil.
Oh my God.
And then after I read Silkworm. And then the full scale obsession for me happened the first time that I ever listened to Lethal White, which is incidentally the first time I read it as well. And my moment was the same as yours, Lindsay.
Yeah.
That Lethal White prologue.
It's the best.
It's just, it cemented it. And I was like, well, I'm in it for the long haul.
We're here. Here we are.
Yeah. This is where it's happening. It was like, as soon as, you know, you hear the feel of her was new and familiar.
Oh my God.
His arms felt like home. Come on.
Christ. Yes. Yes. Mm-hmm. That was my moment. Ooh. The hug on the stairs. Yeah. That was my moment.
It was a Kairos moment for a lot of us, wasn't it?
Definitely.
Mine is, I guess, a bit different because I read Cuckoo's Calling as soon as it was revealed. It was Rowling because I'm a huge Harry Potter fan, obviously. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I liked it, but I wasn't obsessed mm-hmm. with it. And at the time, I was like, oh, it would be so great if she like bucked the stereotypes and made them be friends, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, I just want them to be friends. And then I read Silkworm once it came out, and that hand kiss at the end, I was like, oh no, they can't just be friends. But maybe all like tiny part of me will insincerely hope that maybe they're just friends, but really it wasn't. And then our career of evil and the cliffhanger. Ending, it
hooked you.
It hooked me. I was super hooked immediately, obsessed. I love a grand gesture.
I think that I might have been if you hadn't been cut open.
I was not cut open. I was I think I was in my undergrad degree at that point, but I was obsessed. And I've always been a fandom person. I know that you're not really, Lindsay. You're like only like the strike fan. But I am a fandom person. I am obsessed with something. I'm going to go find fanfic of a person. I'm going to reblog all the shit on Tumblr about a person. So I went to look for fanfic, and there were like three. There were three. I was so obsessed that I eventually wrote, for the first time since I was a kid, actual fanfic. And started relearning Photoshop to do GIFs once the TV show came out. Because that was the only content we'd had in 3 years, and I was desperate. I dived headfirst in the fandom, and I was big in the fandom for those 3 years, that Lethal Weight. Like, it was hard, and wrote, and was consumed. It was that cliffhanger that got me. Yeah, and ever since then.
And the rest is history for all of us. Send us your moments.
Yes.
Send us your moments of when you became a strike nutter.
Just full descent.
When did you enter your nutter era?
Yes. Let us know.
The nutter era.
I really like how she was so specific that she had that one moment. That was really great.
That was really great.
If she wants one other moment, I remember Lethal White when Strike, it says, you know, he would never tell another woman that he loved her unless.
Oh my God. Oh,
the vow.
I remember sitting in my living room by myself. I looked up and looked around. There's nobody in there, but I was like, did you guys just see that? Like, there are other people. I could not believe it.
Well, that's why you had to start a podcast, so that you could say that to other people, right?
And then I had that same moment when Robin thinks that she just wishes that she had a wedding day and honeymoon that was safe to think back on. And I was just like, girl, is everybody seeing what I'm seeing?
It's right there.
Yeah. Those are specific moments I remember too. Oh, yeah. That's one of the reasons I love Lethal White so much. It just has so many of those, oh my God, this is happening moments for me. Yeah. So good. Love them. Okay. Chapter 79.
In chapter 79, Strike listens to the dictaphone tape with Farrah Navabi's interview with Kevin Pirbright. And then the epigraph for this chapter, 6 in the third place means one is enriched through unfortunate events. And that is from hexagram 42, increase.
Lots of unfortunate events happening.
A series of them.
It's a series, yeah. This is probably mostly talking about the recording, since that's what takes up the bulk of the chapter. It was an unfortunate recording and unfortunate for Kevin. It does end up helping Strike.
Yep, I think you're so right there. The judgment on this one elaborates. A time of blessing and enrichment has such powerful effects that even events ordinarily unfortunate must turn out to the advantage of those affected by them. So this recording, it was unfortunate for Patterson. The whole situation, unfortunate for Kevin, like you said. It's unfortunate for Strike that Patterson Inc.'s incompetence have left him with this mess of a recording. But in the end, the whole solution to the mystery is on this tape. It's all on here. And this is a dark time in the book generally. But everything that's happening in this part is ultimately going to lead to the good ending that we get.
Yes.
We just have to hold on to that.
The opening of this made me laugh. Relieved to have one problem crossed off his list, Strike returned to the office, eating and despising the carob bar he picked up en route in tribute to his renewed commitment to weight loss. I had to Google what a carob bar was, though, and I have to say it doesn't sound great, but it's just funny.
It does not sound good.
No, not so much.
Eating and despising.
I know. That's why it's so funny.
Quite strong, but very funny.
So Strike has made his way back to the office, and we see that Little John, surprisingly, has dropped off the recording of Kevin Furbright as promised. And we also find out that Mitch told Pat that Strike insulted her.
It's kind of funny to me that Pat seems so keen to tell Strike about this.
Did you know?
Yeah. But, you know, if we're going to talk about insults, I feel like Midge won that contest. That one was brutal.
It was.
Strike thinks about how he knows he overreacted. It says he'd been toying with the idea of telling Midge she can go back on the Franks case as long as there was no more fraternizing with the client. But the news that she'd been complaining to Pat aggravated him. First of all, this is very relatable. I totally get hearing this and any good feelings just whoosh, gone. Mm-hmm. But I do think it's important that he still doesn't want her fraternizing with Tasha, the client. You know, for reasons I gave in the last episode, I do agree with this. There's nothing wrong with them seeing each other after the case is over. I do think it's generally a good rule that they shouldn't be hanging out with or dating clients. This interaction, though, between Strike and Pat is pure gold. Mm-hmm. I knew another lesbian once, said Pat. Yeah, said Strike, as the kettle lid began to rattle. Did she bitch behind her boss's back as well? No, said Pat. She was the boss. Nice woman. People took her for hard as nails, but she was soft underneath. Very kind when I had my divorce. No, that sounds like Strike, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. Soft underneath.
I always love some good Pat backstory. And first of all, I want to hear more about the divorce and that first husband that made her hate Strike at first, because that sounds juicy. But also, does this feel like one of those plan to mention, a little mention of a character who'll appear in a future novel moments to anyone else?
You mean you think we'll meet her first husband?
No, I meant we'll meet the lesbian boss.
Oh, okay.
Even though you weren't talking about Pat's first husband, I think it would be interesting to find out more about her first marriage.
I do too. That's what I thought you meant.
Yeah, I thought that would be really fun.
I do want to find that out. Yeah. I think we might see this lesbian boss who sounds pretty great.
I just think it's so funny that Pat knew one lesbian. That's it.
Just one.
Just the one.
I mean, that's enough to make her an expert.
Clearly.
It's probably a safe bet, knowing Pat, to think that she's judging Midge by this one other lesbian she knew. Mm-hmm. Or at least that's what happened when she first met her.
Mm-hmm. Oh, no. It's a parallel to Strike being biased towards nurses in troubled blood.
I'm glad to see that there's zero tension left over from Pat's lie to Strike. They're completely still at their normal, slightly bickering selves.
Yeah.
So much fun to read.
It is. It seems to me that they're even more... tiny bit more open than they were before, maybe. I mean, it could just be me, but I feel like Pat opening up about her age somehow made both of them more willing to talk about everything.
Let's talk about some more stuff, you two.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I can't point to anything specific, but I just sense it. I just feel it here.
I was feeling the exact same thing. I picked up on that too. So good. So I don't think it's just you. I feel like she seems much more willing to talk and be open now that she doesn't have to worry about, I'm 67. Because if that's the worst thing.
She's good.
Pat tells Strike that her daughter was able to successfully friend Carrie Curtis Woods, or Cherie, on Facebook, and Strike is understandably thrilled about it.
I don't understand this. I mean, I do, but I wouldn't have accepted this friend request.
Right. Neither would I. Mm-hmm. I guess that people have different levels of concern about internet security.
I'm just saying, never accept a follow request from someone you don't know. It could be a private detective trying to question you about your involvement in an old murder. You never know.
Yes.
Also, she put a lot of identifying information on social media.
Oh my God, so much.
I love how cheerful this makes Strike, and that he's going to buy Rhoda a bottle or two of gin.
Rhoda is the new social media sleuth intern.
Ah, could be.
I thought it would be a youth, but no. Like mother, like daughter, Rhoda has the chops here.
Yeah.
Also, I would like to sign up for some gin courtesy of Strike. Thank you.
I'd like to sign up for some Strike courtesy of gin. Thank you. Just kidding.
No, that's good. That's good. That's a good comeback. Mm-hmm. It was the old, you switched it.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. That was good.
Remember a switcheroo.
Switcheroo. Mm-hmm.
I feel like Jin got a couple of moments in the spotlight in this book, because he mentions it again in chapter 95 when he and Robin are talking about her friend that had her energy healed or whatever.
So funny.
That
was hilarious.
I wonder if Joe is like a big fan of Jin.
I mean, yeah, love me some gin.
He's also feeling happier because he's made a tentative plan to interview Cherie on Friday, and then he hopes to go visit Robin at home while Murphy's still away in Spain.
That was too cute.
I know.
He wants to see her. Although he clearly still has no conception just how rough
he just thinks she's going to be tired. He has no idea.
He has no idea.
How bad.
Of course, we know that none of that is happening.
Yeah, none of it.
All right, so let's get to the tape with Kevin, because there's a lot of good stuff here.
Oh, yeah. So I love the immediate dig at Patterson that he knew why he hadn't handed the tape over to Sir Colin, because it would have been hard to imagine a poor advertisement for his agency's surveillance skills. He thinks it's something Nutley would do.
Oh, ouch. Is this whole scene kind of a deliberate contrast to him listening to the tape of Robin and Pez Pierce in Ink Black Heart? Because they were in a pub. But the only time the audio was poor quality then was when they were making out.
Well, that's just silence, right?
Yeah, and that's silence.
It does definitely show how Robin can do a good job.
I think it just shows how good Robin is.
Yeah. I mean, the pub was less crowded. There were no men yelling songs in the background. But
true.
So when Strike is talking about how the dictaphone was a poor choice to use and why, my first thought was to be a little bit smug on Strike's behalf. Like, of course, one of Patterson's people chooses one of the worst options to record this interview. Like, I know the first fucking thing about recording devices and which one's the best one to use.
I don't even know what a dictaphone is.
To me, it's like watching people in a cooking show make a mistake and like shouting criticism at the screen while they're making something that you yourself mm-hmm. couldn't make in like a million years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But the point being, Patterson Inc. is like the Wish.com or Temu version of the Strike and Ellicott agency, I think.
Yeah, it's Strike and Ellicott, except you ordered from Wish.
Yes.
So Strike is listening to the tape, and when they finally start talking about the UHC, we can kind of see what they're saying. It's all broken up. I'm guessing Farah said she's always been interested in the UHC, and then Kevin responds, "Don't do it. Sister's still in. Maybe leave one day." Which is kind of mm-hmm. sad. I think he probably cares about his sisters, even if they lied about him.
I mean, I think he knows that Emily at least would punish severely if she refused, mm-hmm. right? He knows she didn't have a choice.
Right.
Becca, on the other hand. But maybe he still even had hope for her.
It's hard to do.
Yeah.
I'm cracking up at Strike's annoyance with the Welshman singing so loudly that mm-hmm. he can't hear them anymore. Yeah. But actually, maybe part of the song is relevant to the story. So the lyrics that they sing, "But Will is very happy, though his money has all gone. He swapped five photos of his wife for one of Barry John." Obviously, I don't think the joke about the photo is relevant, but I'd like to think Will Enzer is happy, or ends up being happy, even though he's lost all his money to the UHC.
Eventually. Eventually. Yeah. I looked up the song, obviously, and the artist on Spotify. Mm-hmm. I was listening to it, and I don't know if this is just the live version, but it starts off with the Augie, 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 Oi, Oi, Oi chant. Also, very interesting fact, probably an enormous coincidence, the album that this is on was recorded on November 23rd, 1973. Mm-hmm. 1 year to the day before Strike's birth, this song was recorded on this live album.
Nice. Ooh.
And then it was released in 1974, the year of our man Strike's birth. I dove into this, and I think listening to the song, I feel like this is kind of a little echo to Strike bursting out into what was the name of that song he sang in Troubled Blood with the Fisher
Chips? It was the Song of the Western Men.
Right. When he sang that, these two songs have kind of the same adorable vibe. It was very adorable. They have the same vibe. It's like the national pride of the underdog who aren't soft Southerners, right? Except in this case, it's Welsh rather than Cornish. But these two songs are very much the same vibe.
Yeah, they are.
It probably means nothing, but I just think it's a very cool coincidence it was recorded on that day.
The next bit he hears is Kevin saying the UHC is evil and hypocritical, and that he's writing a book. And then things get really interesting. I'm going to sum up what I think Kevin is saying in this part. Remember, it's all cutting out, so it's written like that too.
Yeah.
Here's what I think it says. Mm-hmm. "She said drowned, funny things happening, things I keep remembering, four of them, more than just Cherie, nice to the kids, and she... Becca made Emily invisible bullshit."
Yeah.
So then Farah seems to ask for confirmation that Becca made Emily lie.
Mm-hmm.
So he's saying that she said "Die, you drowned." I'm assuming he means Cherie said "Die, you drowned." Mm-hmm. But then it says there's four of them, more than just Cherie. He's talking about the four people involved in Dai's death: Abigail, Cherie, Jordan Reedy, and Paul Draper.
Yeah, I think that's right.
I think the last bit is him saying that Becca made Emily lie and say that Dai was invisible, but he knows that that's bullshit.
Yeah.
The next thing Kevin says, "Drugged, she was allowed out. She could get things, smuggle things in. Let her way with stew. Didn't care about her real. She had chocolate once and I stole some. Bully though." So this one is really fun for me because when I first read this, I thought he was talking about Dayu because everyone else says how spoiled she was, right? So I thought that's who he was talking about, that she's getting to leave, getting to bring things in, having chocolate. But it's not. He's talking about Abigail. Abigail was the one with the chocolate and she was the one who was the bully.
Yes, exactly. And I think there's a little clue coming up here because the next thing that Kevin says is that he's going to talk to her, that she's going to meet him. And it makes sense that this is the same she that he's just talking about, right?
Yes.
Which is obviously not Dayu. Unless, of course, it's the whole, oh, Dayu's still alive, red herring, you're double fucking with us kind of thing.
Ferris responds to that and says, is someone from the church going to meet you? So yeah, we know it has to be someone still alive.
Yeah.
I'm also so annoyed at how bad Ferret is at this, because if she would have just listened to him, he's telling her the whole story.
Literally, the whole murder.
Maybe there's some sort of remedial how to not be a shit detective classes she can take.
Maybe. The next line Kevin says is, and answer for it. So he's saying he's going to make Abigail answer for killing Dayu, right?
Yeah.
What do you think the next words are? It just says Opie part of...
I think it says Dopey was part of it.
Oh, yes. Yes. Dopey. And then there's also Shad RT in the pigs.
Yes.
I think this is she had a hard time and the pigs.
Yeah. Which would be connected to why she needed Dopey, aka Paul Draper, to handle the pigs. Right? It's all there.
Yeah. Farrah is again proving herself to be completely useless when she tells him to stop talking about the pigs. And I love Strike yelling at the recorder to let him talk about the pigs. Yeah. It totally reminds me of Robin yelling at the interview with Becca.
Yes, exactly. They're the same.
I know.
It's also really relatable. I feel like a lot of our listeners might relate to this too, with the number of comments we've had saying that people like talk back to us.
Probably yeah. Saying, can you guys please stay on topic already?
Stop going off about nonsense. Yeah.
Okay, so I feel like I'm kind of kicking myself for not fully understanding the next bit here. I think the start of what Kevin said was either about Jordan or Paul. I think what it's saying is he liked pigs. He knew what to do.
Yeah.
Obviously, meaning he knew what to do to get them to eat the body. And let me just read exactly how this is written. And then I'll tell you what I think it says. It says, and I was in the woo, and Becca old me off because Ace's dot missin' snitch. Okay. I think this was, I was in the woods and Becca told me off because Wace's daughter mustn't snitch.
Yeah.
Again, I had figured Ace's dot meant Wace's daughter, but I was still thinking Dayu, not Abigail.
Yeah.
He's saying that Becca told him off because he was going to tell what he saw, but because Abigail is Wace's daughter, they can't snitch on her.
Mm-hmm.
It's amazing how much easier this is to put together, like what he's saying now that we know the ending. This is just so much fun.
We feel so smart.
You're like, oh, look at us. We're getting it.
I barely even read this the first time. I'm like, oh, there's a bunch of words. Get to Robin.
I know.
Get her out.
So yeah. Worried. Answer this for me. So we've been sitting here wondering how Kevin figured it all out. Is he saying that he saw it happen, blocked it out, and then started to remember things?
Actually, I think what this is referring to is when he saw Abigail burning rope in the woods afterwards, right?
Okay.
Because that's why later he talks about the gale blowing and it being too wet to burn the rope and somebody threatening him. I think he witnessed her trying to clean up like the
crime
day
scene.
After the crime scene. And then later pieced it together about the pigs because they'd escaped, right? And that's what Strike says that Kevin witnessed in the confrontation chapter.
Okay.
He says that Kevin told Becca about Abigail burning something in the woods.
Okay.
And Robin found that bit of burnt rope, right?
Right.
So he witnessed that, not
the actual
murder. Yeah.
Because I was going to say that would be so traumatizing.
Imagine.
Yeah.
I don't think that's what he saw, but.
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
I don't know if I'd ever eat bacon again. I'd probably eat bacon again.
Yeah, I think I could get over it.
You can manage it.
The next line is Farrah speaking, and it says, Dayu in the woods. I wonder if Farrah understood what he was saying. Is this her asking him, did they kill Dayu in the woods, or is she asking something else? I don't see what else she could be asking, given what Kevin's just said. What do you think?
It could have been something like, you saw Dayu in the woods, to give Patterson the benefit of the doubt. Kevin is pretty incoherent here.
Yeah.
So it's possible she couldn't make sense of what he was saying.
Or maybe they just dismissed it all as nonsense anyway, didn't believe it.
If Robin had been conducting this interview, they'd have solved the murder 18 months ago.
I think so. Mm-hmm. From what I can make out of this next bit, Kevin is saying that he thinks there was a plot, I'm assuming to kill Dayu, that yep. they were in it together. They were always together. And if I'm right, there will be retribution probably. Mm-hmm. Okay. And then this next bit is what you were talking about with the gale yes. blowing.
That Kevin then was in the woods. There was a storm. He witnessed Abigail trying to burn something. It was too wet. Mm-hmm. He thought it was weird. She threatened him. He ran out of there and he thought it might've been a punishment. Becca told him something. That's basically what's happening here.
Yeah. yeah.
So that's the whole recording.
That's the whole recording. Mm-hmm.
That I yep. did not read the first time through properly.
I yeah. mean, I looked at it with my eyeballs.
I looked at it. I saw it with my eyeballs yeah. and then I moved on.
And absorbed none of it.
I assigned zero brain cells.
Which really, we should have known better. It literally says it was Wace's daughter. It literally says it.
So I'm not smart. I never claimed to be smart. I'm Orange Cat. I have zero brain cells. Only love for Strike and Robin.
I'm just saying. The clues are all over this book.
I'm going to do the exact same goddamn thing in the Hallmarked Man.
We all are. It's yep. part of the fun.
All right. So then the recording ends when Kevin leaves to be sick in the bathroom and then Farrah leaves.
Did Farrah help Kevin get home or what? Because it'd be pretty awful to leave him there in that state.
I think she did just leave.
She just left him there?
That's what it sounds like to me. She just walks away.
What an asshole. Well,
fuck you, Farrah.
Seriously. I'm just going to say that nobody from the Strike and Ellicott agency would have done that.
None of them would have fucked this up so badly. Say you what you will about insubordination on some of their parts, but they're all competent.
Who are you talking about?
Midge. Oh, you know what I'm talking about. You're just doing the old, yeah, I gotcha.
Okay, let's go to chapter 80.
All right. In chapter 80, Strike receives an update from Dev that the plastic rock they used to communicate with Robin is gone.
And the epigraph. External conditions hinder the advance, just as loss of the wheel spoke stops the progress of a wagon. And that's hexagram 9, the taming power of the small. I think this is talking about things happening out of your control that stops you from moving forward. So Strike and Lucy can't really move forward yet with a plan for Ted because they don't have all the information yet. And Greg's being Greg, and then Strike's plans to interview Cherie and for Dev to have picked up Robin are completely thrown off when Robin doesn't turn up at the rock.
Yeah, agreed on all points. I think there's also a little pointer here towards this conflict between Greg and Lucy too, because right after the line in the epigraph, it says, "We do not yet heed this hint from fate. Hence, there are annoying arguments like those of a married couple." Yeah. Yeah, the married couple is definitely arguing, and I'm annoyed by Greg.
We start the chapter with news that Dev is on his way to get Robin and Strike is headed to Lucy's.
I know we keep saying that it has to be Strike, but thank God it was Strike just because of how raw and vulnerable Robin is when she gets yeah. out. Mm-hmm. Not that Dev wouldn't handle it well. It's just that she needs her best friend. You know,
her main man. Her knight in BMW. Yeah.
Yeah.
We're so close. How many chapters away are we? What number is the escape?
We're in the right tens group now. Oh, we're in chapter 80.
We're in the tens. Mm-hmm. We're in the 80s. Oh, we're so close.
Yeah. So next we get an update on Ted that's just really sad. Just to summarize, he's not really there, not following conversation or understanding what's going on or even who Lucy's boys are. But this part that talks about the moment where the old Ted would shine through, it really reminded me of Will. It's like the brainwashing of the cult has a similar effect as dementia.
Oh, God, that's so sad. Mm-hmm. It does. It seems like Ted's going downhill very quickly. Talking about this, everyone should go read Louise Freeman's posts about Ted's diagnosis because it's fascinating and it makes a lot of sense to me. She argues that Ted has a form of vascular dementia, which is caused by a series of small strokes as opposed to Alzheimer's. Mm-hmm. It's different. And it's characterized by sudden onset, sharp decline, mobility problems, depression, and transient ischemic attacks, which are those little funny turns, right? Mm. But this is important because for the future, as Freeman notes, this type of dementia has a much shorter expected lifespan and can foretell future major strokes.
Yeah.
So that's not good news for Ted.
Nope. So this argument or conversation that happens between Lucy, Greg, and Strike is something.
Yeah.
I do think that Greg could be more sympathetic. I do think that he's right about part of this. Lucy wanting Ted to come live with them is fine if she didn't have a full-time job. Greg is right that looking after him would be like a full-time job, and he's not safe there by himself.
They would have had to hire someone to come in
right.
with full time and take care of him. Like, mm-hmm. it's not reasonable.
Right. But where Greg is absolutely ridiculous is to argue against putting him in a home in London and allowing Ted to stay in Cornwall. Like,
yeah.
What is that?
This is where I started raging at Greg. I'm you? Like, fuck you, Greg. Fuck you. Fuck Agreed. Your family. Fuck your cow. No, fuck all not y'all. His
family. How do you really feel about Greg?
Oh, that.
He sucks so much.
This just suggests to me that he doesn't actually care, because anyone with half a brain knows that he cannot stay in Cornwall. We all know this.
Yeah, 100%. It is so clearly not an option that my opinion of Greg sank even lower with this. And as you guys know, my opinion was already at rock bottom.
It's true.
He's so incredibly unsupportive. And saying that he doesn't want him in a home in London because Lucy will be running around after him. Dude, that's the reality of life. That's what happens when you have parents who are aging. You can't just leave them alone to die in a house fire because they left a TV plugged in, or wander into the ocean because it's inconvenient for you to have your wife visiting them.
A TV plugged in caused the house fire. It's so unrealistic.
But it's more realistic that he'll leave the oven on.
Literally everyone leaves the TV plugged in.
Well, if you stick around for our partners chat, you'll be able to hear us talk all about irrational fears.
We recorded the partners chat before this. It's a reference. I'm very afraid of house fires.
You will see why at the end of this episode.
A bit crazy. Stick around.
Oh, okay.
But anyways, Craig says, so sell the boat. Like, that will fix the possibility of Ted being harmed somehow. If he just doesn't have a boat, he'll be fine.
It's stupid.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I'm ranting. I'm raging. Mm-hmm. And it's also pretty unfair to Strike, who's been doing much better with the whole like family thing.
He had to throw in a little dig at Strike there, I think.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Strike's been doing pretty good with Ted. He did good with Joan. He's doing way better. Don't be mean, Greg. Mm-hmm. I might be a minority of one here, but I'm still feeling a divorce plot coming up for Lucy and Greg.
I have no feelings about this.
I will join you there. I hope they do.
Thank you, Kenz. Me too.
Mainly because I've not liked Greg ever since those shitty comments that he made towards Nick and Ilsa in Silkworm.
He's been on my shit list since he manned the iPod at a birthday party.
You really take great issue with manning the iPod.
That's not a job put on a playlist. You're being ridiculous, Greg.
If you have a very particular playlist that you have curated, sometimes you got to change up the playlist to match the vibe of the party.
No, just set it and forget it, my dude. That's not a job.
But yeah, I've hated him since Silkworm, since he made those comments to Nick and Ilsa. But his attitude here is really just, it's awful. And Lucy deserves better than that.
Yes, she does.
Okay, so Strike is at Lucy's house Thursday night, right? When Dev should have picked Robin up. So then the next morning when Strike is driving down to Cherie's, that's Friday.
Yes, it's Friday, manifestation day, the day of Dio's death.
Okay.
Oh boy.
I have to laugh at myself here because I remember reading this for the first time and saying, nope, turn around, Strike. I was yelling it at the book. I knew that he was driving up to Norfolk today.
100%. Yeah.
We knew it.
He's not leaving his girl in that place. And she being drowned, assaulted left and right.
Strike then gets a phone call from Tasha Mayo to request that Midge be returned to her case.
My concern about the Frank seeing Tasha and Midge together grew after this phone call, because Tasha describes this as walking around together when Midge is supposed to be unseen, not next to her.
They're in love.
I think she's giving away way too much information here and she doesn't really realize it.
Yeah.
Strike is just being a bit of a softie when Tasha starts crying, because they really shouldn't be having a laugh together, as Tasha says. Midge is supposed to be watching the Franks and getting evidence, you know. Maybe Tasha just means knowing Midge is out there in some sort of romantic... I just know she's there. I feel safer, but I don't know. I'm glad it all worked out. I wouldn't like this.
Yeah.
She's having her Jane Eyre moment.
You know what? I can admit that you're technically correct on all points. Sure. Yes.
Thank you.
Okay.
Say it without the technically.
No, I will not. Some things are more important.
But listen.
And those things are true love.
This is the most serious side case they've ever had. This is a life or death situation.
And Midge could kick both of those Frank's asses. So she should be on Tasha like glue on construction paper doing crafts.
You know what I mean. This is a very serious case. Yes, and it should not be putting the agency, not the agency at risk, but the case at risk by letting the Franks know that they're being watched. Oh,
that's such a good twist for the romance novel when her love for Tasha leads to a compromise and puts her in danger.
Oh, God.
Lord, oh, I need to write it now.
I'm making it worse.
God. You are making it worse. And by worse, I mean amazing. I'm shipping it so hard. I'm so on board with this.
Okay.
Some things are more important. And those things are true love. So you may be correct. Yes.
I mean,
no points. Sure.
Sure. Not if she gets murdered, though.
Well, she doesn't. So it's fine. I really feel for Tasha here, though, because she's scared. You know, she's being stalked and Midge makes her feel safe and it lightens up her life a bit. It's nice to be able to have a laugh with someone when you're living in constant fear of what these two freaks will do to you, even if you're not supposed to be doing that. You know, Midge and Strike, they're both human beings and they both really feel for this woman who's having a hard time. So Strike is a softie and Midge is fraternizing with the client. Not the enemy. Fraternizing with the enemy is the cardinal sin, according to Ron Weasley.
Right.
Just have to make sure the reference.
I understood the reference. Yeah.
And you know, Strick doesn't once think about this impeding the actual investigation of the Franks.
Well, he should have.
Yeah. It doesn't seem like it's his primary worry. And you know, I'm not too worried. From what we've seen, they don't seem smart enough.
Well, they have eyes.
Do they?
They have eyes and they're real good at watching women.
Yeah. Ugh.
He does tell Midge she can go back as long as they aren't hanging out. So he's still not wanting that to happen. That's still a thing.
Trial he likes. There's no stopping true love.
Oh, God.
I'm a romantic and so is Strike.
Okay, so then Dev calls. I don't know how Strike managed to wait for Dev to call.
Right? How is he not texting for updates all night?
I don't know.
How is it not literally the first thing he did when he woke up in the morning?
I don't know.
You roll over, you pick up your phone, you text Dev.
I know. It is so cute, though, when Strike asks if he has her, smiling in anticipation of hearing Robin's voice.
Oh, he was so ready to hear her.
And he hadn't heard it in 4 months, and we know how much he relies on it.
I was freaking out, not only because Dev does not have her, but the rock is gone.
Not good. Yeah. Not good.
The Very rock being bad. Gone is what scared me the most because I thought Will told everything and her cover was completely blown, which I'm sure is what we were meant to think. I was panicking.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Me too. So scared.
Oh, it says for the second time in 2 weeks, Strike felt as though dry ice had slid down through his guts. Same, Strike. Same.
Just a note, this is basically the exact same phrasing that Robin used when Charlotte told her about Madeline and she realized she was in love with Strike. She said, you didn't feel as though all your intestines had been seared with dry ice when you found out your friend was sleeping with someone new. They both got the dry ice in their guts.
Yeah.
Also, so hang on. So Will's already stolen the rock by Thursday night.
Yeah.
He demanded the farmhouse and then that night he went to steal the rock.
How did he sneak around?
How did he sneak out?
Maybe the men's dormitory door is in a different place.
Oh, yeah. So he can like skirt it.
Yeah.
That's possible. That's the only thing that makes sense.
And then, of course, as I knew would happen, Strike turns around to race off to Robin.
Obviously.
Yeah. Go
get your woman.
Here he comes, the cavalry.
Okay, let's go to chapter 81.
In chapter 81, Robin attends the manifestation of the drowned prophet and nearly drowns.
The epigraph for this chapter reads, "The upper trigram Khan stands for the abysmal, the dangerous. Its motion is downward." And that's from hexagram 3, difficulty at the beginning.
I think its motion is downward is talking about the pool pulling her under.
Yeah, I think you're right. It's interesting that this is the difficulty at the beginning hexagram because we're nearly at the end of her time in the cult, right? We're at the climax. But I think it speaks to the cyclical nature of the I Ching because the end of the cult is the beginning of the next part. Right? With Robin raining the thunder down on this place.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the lines from this hexagram speaks to that, I think. It says, "The situation points to teeming, chaotic profusion. Thunder and rain fill the air, but the chaos clears up. While the abysmal sinks, the upward movement eventually passes beyond the danger. A thunderstorm brings release from tension and all things breathe freely again." So this is hinting, even though it's downward, even though it's pulling her down, she's about to bob back up and she's about to turn the tables on him.
I can't wait. We're going to have so much fun doing these next parts.
Going to be such a relief.
I know, to get out of this. I know.
So the chapter opens with nobody had confronted her about her real identity. Nobody had spoken to her about what had happened in the retreat room with Will or challenged her explanation of why her face was swollen and bruised. And she found all of this ominous rather than reassuring. She felt certain that a reckoning was coming at a time of the church's choosing and afraid that the manifestation would be the moment it happened. The drowned prophet will sort you out.
Ugh, how did we all survive reading this book for the first time? Seriously.
I didn't. I'm a ghost.
This is the most stressful book I think I have ever read. It's wonderful, but oh my God.
Right. You think that Career of Evil is stressful.
Not so much. That's an okay level of stress for me. This was off the charts.
Yeah.
It's pretty rough.
Whew. Knowing she missed the rock the previous night, Robin thinks about how if she hadn't overruled Strike about the 1 day rule, somebody might be on their way to get her.
Somebody is on their way to get you, Robin.
Mm-hmm. Oh my God, he's on his way.
And the if I get through the manifestation, she thought I'll get out tomorrow night. It's actually true, right?
Yep.
This is what happens. But the if I get through it, it's so sad to know that she knows how much danger she's in. If I get through it.
Oh, it's so sad. And she tries to talk herself out of it, tell herself, oh, she's being paranoid. But you know what? Her instincts are spot on here. She's in huge danger.
It says Robin spoke to nobody, wishing she could somehow physically summon those who cared about her in the outside world. This almost feels like that soul connection we keep talking about and the Jay and Eric connection where she's calling out to him, not knowing that he's answering her call. He's on his way.
He's driving up to wait. This is when Strike is waiting for her.
That bit that you were just reading reminds me a bit of the chapter in Deathly Hallows when, you know, you have Harry in the Resurrection Stone when he's walking with his parents and Sirius and Lupin to face Voldemort in the forest.
Oh my God. Oh my God. It is just like that.
The whole thing sounds absolutely terrifying. Mm-hmm. They're being led in complete darkness. Robin is forced into a kneeling position in front of the stage, although she doesn't know she's in front of the stage yet. She doesn't know who she's next to. Wace's voice appearing and the chant going. Oh, I don't like it.
I don't like it,
and I'm nervous. We've talked a lot about truth and justice, especially in this book. These are the core values held by Strike and Robin, right? And here Jonathan Wace says, Dayu, beloved prophet, speaker of truths, bringer of justice, come to us now in holiness. I don't know what I'm thinking here other than it's another example of the phony versus the real. Mm-hmm. The drowned prophet and the UHC are not speakers of truth or bringers of justice. Strike and Robin are.
Absolutely. But, you know, Dayu herself was the victim, not a prophet. Robin is the one who's going to be bringing the justice to her.
Yeah.
She's the one who's going to be bringing the justice to this drowned prophet.
Yeah.
She's flipped it.
Dayu then shows up and has this conversation with Jonathan Wace about things being wrong and there being wickedness both inside and outside the church.
Obviously, this is all set up.
Yeah.
I'm sure they adjust what Dayu says every year to fit with who they want to punish.
Yeah. They must have some poor kid doing this voice, having to say all this nonsense into a mic.
Right. It is kind of funny to have to imagine Jonathan Wace rehearsing his lines in the office.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That is pretty funny.
It's like and so absurd. Stupid. So yeah. Stupid. Yeah. Okay. So this is when the pool starts glowing, right? And with this glow is when Robin realizes that she's been placed in the very front row next to the pool.
Oh gosh. What a coincidence that the person Dayu wants to punish is right up front.
So weird.
That's so crazy.
Yeah.
It's proof of the divine whatever, blah, blah,
blah.
It
is. It's the blessed divinity.
Sure. Yes. That thing.
So more creepy water stuff. Now the glowing water rose upwards in the smooth shape of a bell jar, and revolving slowly inside it was the figure of a limp, eyeless child in a white dress. The water was sinking again, and with it, the dreadful figure. And after a few seconds, the greenish water was flat again, though glowing brighter still, so that the figures of Jonathan and Mazu, who were standing on the edge of the pool in their long white robes, were illuminated from beneath.
Oh, with this, we're getting into some actual horror movie shit. And I don't like it. It's very scary. No,
yeah, I'm wondering
you.
How they did this. It can't be the pepper ghost trick. Was it some sort of projection onto water?
I don't know. I was thinking like a mannequin on a pole or something because it's eyeless. That's not a standing child. It's a it's a creepy prop that could actually be in the water.
Maybe.
Is it some kind of like fountain? This one I have no idea about, actually.
I kind of think that it could be projection onto water because they actually do this at Disneyland a lot. Hmm. There's actually one part, I think it's in Fantasmic, where they do this actual down the drain thing.
Oh.
It's very possible. But I guess a mannequin could work too.
Interesting. I don't know.
All right. So then we get to this little speech from Mazu about how special she is to be Dayu's mother and all of her special gifts, which just make me want to slap her in the face, right? And then she says that the people Dayu will test tonight have nothing to fear if their hearts are pure. And then it says in the next chapter that other people might have gone into the pool after Robin. Of the people we know, who do you think they would have picked?
Will seems like the obvious answer, right?
Yeah, I know.
Because he's in deep shit. Emily? Probably.
Emily is very likely, yeah.
Louise, for funsies, she seems pretty out of favor.
Shauna, maybe. Do you think they would do that if a woman's pregnant? Would they risk?
I don't think they'd risk the baby because that's money.
That's the only reason why.
Right.
100%, yeah.
Next, they call Robin up to the pool and tell her to go in after Dayu.
I'm realizing that the whole illusion they're going for here is that Dayu herself is pulling them under because she went into the water first. This is another thing that is probably obvious, but I did not retain this information in my head. Again, read this book a lot of times. Didn't remember this bit. Trauma.
Yeah.
It says that Robin knew that resistance or refusal would be taken as a sign of guilt.
I genuinely don't think I could have made myself get in this pool like Robin does. Absolutely not. She's very impressive here. She's
very brave.
Yeah.
She's my hero.
She's my hero too.
So next we get to the really stressful part. So buckle in. The light in the water dimmed. Robin expected her feet to touch the bottom, but they met no resistance. The bottom of the pool had disappeared. She tried to swim for the surface, but then, to her terror, felt something like smooth cord twist around her ankles. In panic, she fought, trying to kick herself free. But whatever had hold of her dragged her downwards. In darkness, she flailed and kicked, trying to rise. But whatever was holding her back was more powerful. And she saw splinters of memories. Her parents, her childhood home, strike in the Land Rover. And the cold water seemed to be crushing her, pressing on her very brain. It was impossible to breathe. She opened her mouth in a silent scream and sucked in water.
What do you think was holding on to her? The only thing I can think is that when it says that the floor had disappeared, I think that the bottom opens up into another pool area and they have divers go in from that way. And there are people down there holding her under. I don't know how else this would work.
Yeah, there has to be a diver in there somewhere. If not like a separate pool, like under access. In the dark, when no one could see, someone could have slipped into the pool with like, I don't know, the breathing.
Sure, equipment. But then what's the point of floor disappearing?
I have no idea. But why does it feel like a cord around her ankle than someone grabbing it? Because
maybe they have something that they're down further, so they reach up
like one of those
hand grabber things.
No, like one of those things that they use to catch animals in animal control. Like it's a long pole with like a noose over it.
Yeah. Yes, I know exactly what you mean.
Okay, I mean maybe, but it seems risky to try and grab her foot with that in the dark underwater, right?
Wow. Or wearing night vision goggles.
Yeah, but still, dexterity check nailed. I don't know how this works.
It has to be something. It has to be a person because it seems even less likely that it's just some sort of
automatic trap.
Yeah,
like a rabbit snare. Yeah, no,
I don't know.
I don't like it. Whatever it is, stop it.
And then do you think that they have like a set time that they have to hold them under for and then let them go?
Oh my God. Yeah, probably. And I hate this whole thing. This is very
upsetting. Maybe that's why all that diving equipment stuff was on the trademark page. Remember that? Oh.
Connected the dots.
Just kidding.
And I know we've said it before, but is this not a bit of a Deathly Hallows parallel with Harry being dragged down into the pool by the Horcrux chain around his neck? Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Too bad she wasn't pulled out by her best friend.
I know.
But here's all of our favorite in-book parallel between Strike and Robin, thinking of the other in the Land Rover.
It was her last thought. It was her last thought, Strike sitting beside her in the Land Rover. Just pause for a minute and let that sink in.
Yeah.
Her last thought.
It's momentous.
She loves him.
Note that thoughts of Murphy were nowhere to be seen.
Who?
Nowhere.
Who? I never met him, apparently. I swear to God, if Robin does not think about this moment and have some kind of realization about her own feelings in The Hallmarked Man, I am going to riot.
Oh, I know.
I will burn this place to the ground. Mm-hmm. Oh my God. I will do it.
She's got to think about it. She's got to think about it.
She must realize.
She's got to think about who she loves. She's gonna. It's going to be amazing.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to need a scene. Okay, all of this talk about the Land Rover, it's obviously a special place for both of them, right?
Mm-hmm.
They
mm-hmm.
cherish their moments together in the Land Rover, I think. I'm going to need a scene where he kisses her up against the Land Rover, please and thank you.
Oh, my God, my emotions.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Landy's seen some stuff, you know?
Landy has seen some stuff. I just want to say, I know I was talking earlier about that show, The Gentleman, but there's a very upper class, like rich class dude who dies in the first episode. And when it pans over to his funeral, his grave, it's revealed that one of his middle names is Land Rover.
What?
Legit. One of this upper class dude's middle names is Land Rover.
Okay. That is incredible.
And I'm like, if they ever had kids, I feel like they need to give their kid the middle name Land Rover. It's so fucking funny. I'm like, oh my God, his middle name is Land Rover. That's such an upper class twit thing to do, but it's so funny. It made me think of Strike and Robin watching it. So.
Well, obviously, yeah.
Obviously, but yeah. I'm with you on the kiss up against the Land Rover.
Oh, you were named after the bravest car I ever knew.
All right, Ken's with joke of the month. That's hilarious. Yeah.
That was good, Ken. Do you need a round of applause for that one?
Thank you. Thank you.
So funny. Also, one more parallel with Deathly Hallows here.
Yeah.
Ken's mentioned earlier the parallel with the echoes of Harry walking to his death in the forest.
Yeah.
What was Harry's last thought before Voldemort killed him? I'll tell you.
Tell me.
Harry thought inexplicably of Ginny and her blazing look and the feel of her lips on his. If that's not a true love parallel, then what the hell is, right? That's love.
Mm-hmm. Oh, these two kill me.
Like Voldemort, like the pool, we're dead because it's killed us.
I feel like that is its own cult chapter cleanse.
Yeah. Strike and Robin have just Avada Kedavra'd me.
Yeah.
It is a pretty good cult chapter cleanse. Thinking of them kissing up against the Land Rover, thinking of their true love, I do feel cleansed.
I feel cleansed. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Just that last thought. Oh, boy.
Ooh.
That was so good.
That's real soulmate shit.
It is.
Soulmate shit, indeed, Kens. Indeed.
Very eloquent.
Well, concurred.
Okay, let's go to chapter 82.
In chapter 82, Robin is interrogated by Jonathan, Mazu, Tayo, and Becca and put inside of the box for punishment.
Oh, God.
I don't like any of that.
The trigrams Lee, Clarity, and Chen, Shock, Terror, give the prerequisites for a clearing of the atmosphere by the thunderstorm of a criminal trial. And that is from hexagram 55, abundance, fullness.
So Robin basically faces a trial in this chapter where Wace is the judge and the jury. And we have Becca, Mazu, and Tayo all watching as well. He interrogates her about Will and Emily and condemns her to punishment. Wace also says that punishment will purify her. It seems like clearing of the atmosphere fits with that.
This hexagram feels like it's from the point of view of the UHC kind of thing, right? It's abundance. Mm-hmm. They definitely feel like they have it all, like they're in full control of the situation. They're at their peak. But as the hexagram says, the fact that development has reached a peak suggests that this extraordinary condition of abundance cannot be maintained permanently. They are headed for a fall here. They feel like they're the boss now, not for long.
The chapter starts with Robin waking up on the floor vomiting. Thank God.
Yeah. Can you imagine if she died and that been the last point of view we ever got of her? I mean,
it wouldn't
not writing that series, but Jesus, that would have been awful.
I feel like we would have just stopped the podcast.
I'd have stopped. I'm done. I'm out.
Bye.
It's been nice.
Can't do it.
Luckily, that's not going to happen for either of them.
Fuck.
So Tayo's above her wearing night vision goggles.
Mm-hmm.
Tayo's not the only one with night vision goggles, you know? Her main man is about to be out there with some soon, too.
Oh,
hell yeah, he is.
Her knight in night vision.
Yeah, goggles. I like it.
Uh-huh. Not you, Tayo. Fuck off.
Yeah. No. So he takes her away to a room in the farmhouse basement and leaves her there where she starts to sob finally and wishes she had left with Barkley. Same. She can't even think straight to try and come up with a plan. She's so scared.
God. It's just the horror of her near drowning was now eclipsed by terror of what would come next. Yeah. No, me too.
Yeah, it was so hard for me to read this chapter slowly in order to do these notes.
I kept trying to like flip over the pages to get to where she escapes. And I'm like, no, you have to finish reading this one.
You actually have to do it.
Not gonna lie, after every chapter in this section, I flip forward to read the escape and then had to flip back. I'm like, okay, I just gotta know that she's still okay and she still makes it out.
She's still fine. She's still fine.
Nothing's changed. Yeah.
Finally, Jonathan Wace, Tayo, Mazu, and Becca all enter the room.
You know, thinking about what Kevin said in that recording, that it was always the four of them. It's like there's two terrifying groups of four. You know, I kind of feel bad that Paul Draper's roped in with that, but still.
Jonathan Wace then sits across from Robin and asks her why Dai would be so angry with her.
I'd be so tempted to be like, she's not real.
Why is the ghost angry with me? I don't know, dude. Ask her with your Ouija board and find out. Call Henry.
Yeah. So Robin wishes she could see into his mind to know what he already knows. This is what I was most afraid of, because we still don't know if Will told him anything.
Yeah. Wace's little laugh when he says, church members are free to leave anytime. Robin doesn't believe him for a second.
No, none of us do.
What would have happened if she'd called his bluff? Because if she said, I want to leave, and then he kills her, the tape that he's recording becomes dangerous evidence. He wouldn't be able to use it to prove anything about her being there for him for Will. So like, why is he playing into it? I feel like I'm thinking myself in knots here.
Yeah. If they did kill someone, I think they'd destroy the tape. I think the tape is being used for when or if people leave and then claim abuse. They can then show it and say, no, they agreed to all of this, you know?
That makes sense.
I don't know if I've ever been as angry with a villain as I was when Jonathan Wace says, I'm only angered by injustice, Rowena, said Wace quietly. If you've been unjust to us or to Will, there will be a sanction, but it will fit the transgression. As the I Ching tells us, penalties must not be imposed unfairly. They should be restricted to an objective guarding against unjustified excesses.
I want to stab him so much.
Yes, so many times.
I want to shank the fuck out of him.
He's getting a carrot shank.
He's getting a shank and he's got it coming.
I hope he still feels that way when he's being sentenced to prison. You know what I mean? Just how dare you talk about justice?
The audacity.
This guy.
The Darvo. I cannot wait until they burn this church to the ground. Get on it.
I wish we could have seen a scene with how angry they were when this all happened. Ooh, that would have felt so good. I'm just going to imagine it. I'm going to think about that later.
He is just the worst.
So he's really interrogating her about Will and wanting to know if she said anything to him about his mother. I have to imagine that he suspects Robin's there for him and told him his mother died. I don't think he has any proof, but he suspects it. But do you think he believed her story that she was just questioning whether or not they received letters and what if something happened?
I think it's just barely plausible enough that they couldn't disprove this story without Will cooperating, which I don't think he's doing, right? So she's skating by with this, but just barely. Honestly, to me, it was pretty impressive that she came up with this at all, this story, and that she managed to stay in character after everything she's just been through.
Especially given that it just said that she could not think of a plan.
Right.
She still does.
She pulled it off.
Mm-hmm.
She did it.
Amazing.
Yeah. So then they move on to the money that Robin gave to Emily and get her to confess to giving it. I knew this was going to come back.
Mm-hmm.
I know it did good in the end because it got Emily on Robin's side and led to her being able to press her on information about Jacob, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they probably would have put Robin in the box anyways. But I still can't help but wish that she'd just given her a reasonable amount of money.
I know.
Right.
I know. Like just a couple bills.
Yeah. Every time I read this book, I hope and pray that she gives Emily less money this time, but she never does.
She never does.
Robin looked into those opaque, dark blue eyes and remembered the stories of Kevin Purbright and Neve Doherty, of Sheila Kennett and Flora Brewster, all of which had taught her that if there were any safe, easy route out of Chapman Farm, it wouldn't have taken bereavement, mental collapse, or nighttime escapes through barbed wire to free them. She no longer believed the Waces would stop short of murder to protect themselves or their lucrative fiefdom. Waces' offer was for the camera to prove Robin had been given a free choice that was, in reality, no choice at all.
I mean, we've been saying this all along. If you have to escape by climbing over barbed wire or hiding in the trunk of a car, you are a prisoner in a cult.
Yeah.
I'm looking at you, Scientology. Mm-hmm. Send your lawyers after me. Whatever.
She's at Pools VB. I'm just kidding.
yep.
So we have a listener question from Zach about this part. He says, In episode 3, around the 116 mark, you were all discussing how we never see how the UHC deals with people who actively want to leave. Mm-hmm. That made me think of the scene where Robin is interrogated after almost drowning. Wace says she's welcome to leave if she wants, but Robin's internal monologue thinks that's just for the camera. Instead, she voluntarily agrees to be put in that box. What do you think would have happened if Robin said she wanted to leave at this point? Mm-hmm. All I know is when I was reading that scene, I was almost screaming, leave, leave. Robin thinks they'll kill her instead of letting her leave. But now that we know that they're not behind Dayu's death, perhaps that's not the case. So I don't know if we'll ever get an answer on this. I tend to think yes. I'm not sure it would have been a gun to the head like Robin later says, but I'd think they'd find a way to do it accidentally. Mm-hmm. It would have been really easy for them to say, oh, I don't think you fully listened, back into the pool with you, and this time keep her under for longer. Mm-hmm. And do the same thing they did with Deirdre.
I'm torn. I'm torn. We have never seen the church killing someone to prevent them from leaving or killing them after they left. They have let, so far that we've seen, fear do the work for them, whether fear of the drowned prophet or fear of them. And if Robin had said on camera that she wanted to leave and then turned up dead, that's dangerous as hell. And the thing is, Robin, Rowena, is not the kind of person who can just disappear. She's wealthy. She's got family. She's only been in there a few months. I don't think they could be confident enough that they'd get away with it to just kill her.
Well, again, I think they just destroy the tape.
Yeah.
They're not live streaming this conversation, so it's not going to be out there somewhere.
Yeah, they could, but they must know that people are going to come looking for this woman.
Well, they'd probably say she left. We don't know. We don't know where she went. We don't keep tabs on ex-members.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know.
We don't know the answer to this.
We'll never know.
I think that the possibility is high enough that she couldn't just leave.
She accepts the possibility. I think the point is that Robin was so afraid of them because of the atmosphere of this cult. She fully believes they'll kill her. Mm-hmm. Whether they will or not isn't what's important, isn't what matters. It's that she fully believes they will because of the atmosphere they've inculcated in this farm.
We know that they've killed people, so I lean towards yes.
Yeah.
I lean slightly away, but I'm a little in the middle. I don't know.
I think they would have.
So Robin has to say out loud for the camera that she wants to stay and deserves to be punished, uh-huh. as if almost being drowned wasn't enough.
Right.
And then this part was my whole entire nightmare, where I was freaking out and almost in tears when it says that Becca came in with a razor and shaving cream. I was losing my mind. I seriously blocked this out so much because I missed Tayo's shaking his head and Wace agreeing not to shave her head. I missed the whole thing because I was so panicked. Yeah, I got much farther down. I had to go back and reread it again slower to find him saying no, because I didn't know what happened. I was a whole mess.
That's so interesting.
I was such a mess.
I was a little bit like, oh no, Jesus Christ. But I did not have that visceral reaction to this threat that you did.
Yeah.
Like, we had different.
Super did.
This was a super thing for you. Yeah.
Yeah, it was.
Yeah. It was super scary for me too. I'm pretty sure that I gasped at this part and was like out loud, like, oh no, you fucking don't.
Oh, hell no.
Absolutely not. Yeah, exactly.
I guess this is the one time I'm thankful for Tayo being an absolute creep. Oof. It was good for something.
For once.
And he's about to get hit in the face with wire cutters. So.
Oh, we love to see it.
Yeah. Speaking of things we love to see, did you guys see that AI picture that Badly Wired Lamp did of Strike holding the wire cutters? Mm-hmm. I mean, hello, new phone background.
Mm-hmm. He's looking particularly hunky in that one.
Hunky is a good word.
Particularly hunky.
Reading this stupid little speech from Wace about punishment purifying her and how he's so sorry for the necessity of it. All I can think about is how small and defeated I hope he feels when Robin's testifying against him. And she's the one with all the power, you know?
She's the captain now.
Yes. You know how people hate Umbridge more than they hate Voldemort?
Yes.
Wace is the Umbridge to Abigail's Voldemort. Yes. Do you know what I mean? She's the killer.
Yes.
But there's no competition for who I hate more.
Yeah, this makes perfect sense. It's that syrupy, sweet, blatant hypocrisy that just enrages us so much more than murder.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's the Umbridge. Ooh.
Yeah, hate him.
Oh, he's like, I must not tell lies.
I need centaurs to come and just stomp the crap out of him.
Stomp him. Just stomp him with their hooves.
Mm.
You don't need centaurs. Get this.
Get the Canadians on it.
Canadian horde on it.
Thank you for doing that for us.
Thank you for your service.
We Americans don't have hooves, so.
I know.
So the chapter ends with Tayo putting Robin in the box and leaving her there for 8 whole hours.
Fuck this guy.
All of them. All the way off.
Every single one of these guys.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
It's been pointed out before, but I do want to acknowledge an email we got from Lucy a long, long time ago about this being a troubled blood parallel, where we have Margot folded up in a box and now Robin.
This is just so incredibly upsetting to me. I mean, we can talk more about this in the next chapter where we actually read about her experience in the box, but I am beyond a shadow of a doubt convinced that Robin thought about Margot dying while she was in here. There's no way she didn't.
Yeah.
There's no way.
Let's do the cleanliest cleanse that a cult chapter cleanse could ever cleanse.
Let's cleanse it.
Let's cleanse it. Go ahead, fools. You got one?
Yeah, I do. You know what? They're going to kiss.
They are going to kiss.
Strike and Robin are going to kiss.
It's going to happen one day.
Their lips, they're going to meet.
I'm sorry, what?
Together.
On purpose.
On purpose. Purpose. And I feel like it's going to be in the Hallmark, man.
Do you?
I do.
I think it's I think it's possible.
I think it's beyond possible. I admit the possibility, but I also accept the plausibility.
Okay. Okay.
Also feel like we're going to get that this fall. I feel like the Hallmark fan is going to come out this fall and that we are going to read Struck and Robin Kissing in the year of our Lord 2024. Okay. It's only taken us 14 years to get here. And now
I've done my waiting.
I've done my waiting. 14 years of it in Azkaban. I cannot believe we've been waiting for these two to kiss longer than Sirius Black was in Azkaban.
Why 14 years?
He did 12 years. What? Because it's been 14 years since 2010. Didn't the first book come out in 2010?
No. It's been 10 years. The 10-year anniversary just passed this last year.
It came out in 2013.
2010 is when the book took place.
Oh my God, Jesus Christ. It's only taken us 10 years to get here.
Yes.
That sounds less impressive.
A whole ass decade.
A whole ass decade, and finally.
But you know finally. What? It's going to be so worth it.
Oh, electric shocks.
Where do you think they're going to have their first kiss? Whether or not it happens in the Hallmark Man, where do you think it's going to happen?
How can it not be in the Hallmark Man on Strike and Robin Kiss Island? It's literally the acronym. Come on, guys.
This does have potential for me because, as I've already said, I could see a very romantic seaside happenings because of what happened in Whitstable and that they both thought about this.
They both missed thought about
opportunity.
It.
So, okay.
And then they kiss, and then a criminal on Sark sets one of them adrift at sea.
Oh,
sorry.
God.
Oh, Lord.
Lord. Sorry, I ruined it. But I could see them kissing on Sark. Mm. I could see it. I would like to see it.
I could see it happening in the office.
I could see it happening in the office. Yes.
I'm still on the Robin will do it train.
Robin will kiss him.
She's got to make the first move.
Yeah.
The ball is in her court now.
I very much like to hear how it feels.
I would like to hear so many things about it.
Mm-hmm.
Mostly involving Strike's stubble, if he has any.
Yeah, obviously he's gonna have
some. Like some scent details, please.
Mm-hmm. I would like his hands in her hair.
Hand locations, hair details,
all of the details,
the relative hardness of his whole body, how solid he feels,
solid and warm. She liked the feel.
Oh my God. Okay.
She sure did like the feel.
Oh, she sure does.
Well, we will see. I think that the Hallmark Man could either end with them kissing or Robin saying, I love you too.
I feel like we need to see their first kiss. Okay.
We will.
And if she says, I love you too at the end, then no time jump.
Yes, exactly.
Right?
Well, of course we're going to see it.
I feel like it's going to be in the book.
I'd love it. Can you imagine if we are living in the year where we get to read about Strike and Robin kissing and we don't even know it yet?
Oh my God. But yes, most people don't know. Oh my God.
Don't jinx it again, Pools.
I'm not jinxing everything. Jinxing shit, okay? I'm manifesting it.
Okay.
Manifesting.
Mm-hmm. All right. Should we do our partners chat?
Yeah, let's do it.
Yes.
I thought we could have a fun little therapy session today.
I love therapy.
Mm-hmm.
Great.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you guys have any irrational fears? Because I got some that I think are funny.
I feel like, I'm waiting to hear yours because they're going to be top notch.
Okay.
Well, the thing is that I think all of my fears are very rational for the most part.
Let me be the judge of that.
Well, all right. Worried that anything left plugged into the wall will spontaneously catch on fire and burn the house down when we're out of the house or in bed.
Yep.
Any like TV, fridge, wait computers. A
minute. Do you unplug everything?
No, but I just
worry obviously about you can't it. Unplug the fridge.
I can't unplug the fridge. No, I don't go to the extent of unplugging things because like you got to reach behind. It's fucking annoying.
Right.
Like if it feels like a very big source of danger, I might unplug it, like the air fryer for some reason. My husband was telling my mom about this, like it was crazy. And she's like, oh no, that's my fault. And I'm like, why? And she's like, well, I wanted to unplug things to save on power, but you'd only do it if I convinced you that you'd be that there would be fire. And I'm like,
no,
what the fuck, mother? What
the fuck? Traumatizing me for no reason.
Like, and now that fear is deeped in. That's like baked in. The TV is going to burn the house down one day because it's plugged in. That's her fault.
Compared to mine, it sounds very normal.
It's a normal fear. And that's one of my, well, I guess spiders are technically irrational, but the brown recluse is making its way up here with global warming, and that shit will eat your flesh away from your body. We have those
here, Not a fan of spiders.
Rational fear.
Did I tell you about the time that I was laying in Jack's bed and a spider crawled over my face?
Oh.
Nope.
No, and I don't think
you're gonna have to rip all of the skin off your face. That's that's the only option.
I would
option.
Be at it with like like the apricot St. Ives scrub to polish with
all
that
of the
off.
Microplastics.
It was when we first moved into this house Jack's bed was just on the floor. Like the mattress was just on the floor. We hadn't put the bed together yet. And since we were in a new house and he was only about two, I think I laid with him and I slept in his room, his brand new room with him. And I was kind of awake and I just felt it crawl across my mouth and onto my cheek. And I grabbed it with my hand and threw it on the floor, screamedDavid came running in the room.
Horrifying.
As soon as we found it and killed it, I was like, I have to go wash my face. And I told him, I was like, I don't know what to do. I feel traumatized.
Yeah, that would as traumatize you should. Me. And it was so close to crawling into your mouth.
You think my mouth was closed, thank God.
Thank God, because otherwise.
That reminds me of this time when I was in like eighth grade. Okay. Yeah. I was getting ready for school in the morning and I tend to shed a lot.
Yeah.
I felt what felt like a hair on my arm.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And turns out giant ass cockroach.
Oh my God.
Ugh. I was like, I screamed loud, flung my arm across with such force that the cockroach flew off of my arm, hit the opposite wall and died in my bathtub. Hey. It was quite a victory, but not the way that I wanted to start my morning.
I'm not a fan. They might be equal to spiders for me.
For me, the only bug worse than spiders, and I can barely even say the name, are the centipedes, the house centipedes.
It's the leg thing.
It's the legs. I literally will have a panic attack if I see one of those. Honest to God, I can't breathe.
I don't think I've ever seen one in real life.
Oh my God. Thank your lucky stars, because they live up here and they come up through the drains. We haven't seen one in this house, thank God.
All right, Kenz, do you have any irrational fears?
Yes, anxiety is my middle name. Of course, I have some irrational fears.
Right.
Cheers to that.
One of my irrational fears, and I would be willing to bet there's probably one other person who has this out here, is when you're sitting down to pee, having an irrational fear that a snake or something is going to come up and like bite you.
Yeah, no, yeah, 100% toilet snake. That's a normal fear and rational. I think that's happened to people. I'm also afraid of toilet spiders like lurking under the seat and crawling up.
Oh no.
Can you imagine? I would literally expire on the spot.
Is that better or worse than the mouth?
I don't know. I don't know.
I feel like it's worse.
I can't decide. They're both so horrific. Kenz, I feel you on that. I think about that all the time too. And that's scary.
You always got to double check. You never know.
I'm starting to feel like I don't want to share mine because these are normal. Well, you know, I love sharks, but I have an irrational fear of sharks. Well, so not just like I'm in the ocean, one might eat me, even though it's not likely. I'm convinced that there are sharks in the deep end of the pool when I can't see the bottom.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean,
or when I was a kid at the lake, I would feel the panic start in my feet because that's where they would get you first.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Right? The feet, they'd pull you under like in Jaws.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that's a thing.
I get that. After I watched Jaws as a kid, I was legit afraid that like our house would flood and a shark would swim in the night. Ooh.
I watched a lot of shark things as a kid.
Oh, okay.
Jaws, Deep Blue Sea, every shark week, anything sharks I was watching.
Well, know your enemy. Know and love your enemy.
Sure.
Just don't get eaten by them.
Right. That's one. Yeah, if it's and I still feel that though. Like even in the pool, if it's dark and I can't see the bottom, mm-hmm. I get panicky a little bit.
There's a shark that crawled in.
And then my other one is that people can see through my eyes.
Like looking into your eyes from here or looking out of your eyes to your brain?
Like whatever I'm looking at, they can see too.
Okay. Now that's weird one. That's the irrational. Did they implant a chip in your brain? Like,
I don't know. I don't know how it would work.
Yeah.
But they might
don't
do
ask
it.
Me to explain the logistics.
I mean, they might have done it and you'd have just, they'd have wiped your memory if there was a chip in there.
They flashy thinged me.
Yeah. Like in
Men in Black. The MIV did it. Yeah. So like, I just think if my house is a mess and I'm looking at it, I think, oh my God, what if someone else can look at this through my eyes?
Yeah. Yeah.
Or I'm changing. Mm. Oh my God.
Yeah.
What if someone can see this through my
eyes? I do sometimes worry that people can read my thoughts.
Mm.
I don't want that at all.
No.
No, that would be the worst. I think that would probably be the worst thing ever.
Yeah.
I wouldn't like that at all. Because if I knew someone was reading my thoughts, I'd instantly think the worst things that I didn't want them to know. God, right. I wouldn't be, it would be awful.
Or they would just be privy to a lot of Strike and Robin fantasies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They'd be like, what is happening in that person's head?
It's a frightening place in here.
She thinks about cheese so much.
I do think a lot about cheese.
Oh boy. See, yeah, I think I win. I told you guys I was going to win, and I think I won.
I think that one wins. I'm trying to think if I have any more. I am irrationally afraid of touching fish. Like, touching living fish in any way scares the shit out of me, which is why I won't swim in lakes or the ocean.
I've never been touched by a fish in the ocean.
I don't know if I have.
Well, there was the one time where my cousin got slapped in the face by the sea lion. I think I've told you guys that before.
That's not a fish, though. That's a mammal, so that's fine.
Well, no, but it's still hilarious.
Well, yeah, it's funny. It's something about the texture that just, and the dead eyes, they just,
We used to go swimming at Lake Mead a lot, which is near Vegas.
Yeah.
And there's just a ton of, I don't know what kind of fish they are, but there's a ton of them. Yeah, they would come up and like touch your legs and stuff.
It makes me want to vomit. That pedicure thing where they put
you
in a thing with little fish. I'm like, that's torture. That's Gitmo. Shit, like, why are you doing that to yourself willingly? So I can't swim in like natural bodies of water because I'm so afraid of touching a fish.
Do you guys remember watching those old talk shows and like daytime talk shows, Maury or whatever, where they bring out people's irrational fears? There was one that was like cotton.
I remember that one.
Olives.
That was funny. Yeah, he starts crying and running away.
My brother's like, that's all fake. I was, don't ruin it for me.
The cameraman's over there working overtime. Like,
oh, so funny.
Oh my God.
I don't think I have anything like that where it's just a thing. No. Unless someone was like, hold this tarantula, I'd be out of there.
Centipedes for me. Don't even have to hold them. I'm not in the same room. I'm not in the same house. I'm gone. And I would be crying and I'm unable to breathe as I did it. Like, that would elicit that reaction from me.
You would have 100%. The Maury reaction.
I'd have the Maury reaction. I have had the Maury reaction in the past.
That's funny.
Very scary. Well, that was a fun therapy session. I feel like we didn't actually accomplish anything productive other than make ourselves more afraid of things.
Yes.
We've all confirmed that we're totally right to be afraid of all of this for the most part. Maybe not the
eye thing.
I mean, it is theoretically possible. Maybe you were abducted as a child and the aliens are looking at your eyes right now.
Maybe it just comes from not wanting people to see certain things of you.
Yeah, I don't want to be seen either.
Don't perceive me.
I'm going to be worried that someone's looking at my eyes.
See, there you go.
All right.
Oh boy. Okay. We have one other thing to talk about.
Yes,
we do.
I'm excited about this one.
We are all done with the London Challenge, or at least I will be
in
the next day or so. We've decided on our next one.
Yes.
And we'd really love for anyone who wants to join us.
We are doing the North Coast 500 virtual challenge.
Which is the North Coast of?
Scotland.
Ooh,
gorgeous. The Highlands. Exciting. It will take you on a spectacular 500-mile 806 kilometer journey through the Scottish Highlands, a scenic route that has it all, from sandy beaches to beautiful castles and diverse wildlife.
I'm super excited because I love Scotland. Mm-hmm. It's one of my favorite places that we went to when we visited. Aww. For comparison, the London Challenge was 75 miles. This is 500. So it's
huge.
It's a big one.
You'll have plenty of time to join.
Yes, mm-hmm. It's nice because it'll give people plenty of time to join. Lots of time to interact.
Yes.
It should be really fun. We had a lot of fun with the London one.
I had so much. I'm loving this. And it's actually making me much healthier. And fun news, I have my mom joining us on this one. Oh. She's already in there doing her miles.
She's got to change her name to Pools' mom. No, she should change her name to, do you have wine? That'd be great.
Oh, that would be funny. Yeah. But no, she's in there. We're doing it together.
Nice.
And for anyone who isn't caught up on this, this is the Conqueror's Challenges app. And if you would like to know how to get on it or get a referral code for 10% off if you're buying your first challenge, just add us on Twitter and we can help you out. We're not sponsored to do this or anything. We just wanted to get fit for New Year's.
No one wants to sponsor us.
I feel like wine should sponsor us, though. Like just wine as a concept. Like the Wine Council. I don't know.
All right. Well, that was fun. None of us need therapy. Those are all perfectly rational.
I feel qualified to give therapy. I feel qualified to guide others to mental health.
Let's not go too far here. You work on that plug situation and then get back to me.
Yeah, that's fair enough.
All right. What are we doing next time, kids?
In next week's episode, we'll be covering chapters 83 through 87. So super exciting stuff going on here. We're going to see Robin taking care of Jacob. We have Strike getting an update on Jordan Rainey, and then Robin's last conversation with Emily Purbright. But the most important part of all of this, I think we would all agree, is that we see Robin's time at the cult coming to an end and Strike coming to her rescue.
Yay!
So we're finally here and I'm so excited.
That'll do it for this episode. Thank you so much for listening. If you enjoy what you've heard, don't forget to follow us on social media. We're on Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr at the SE Files Pod. You can also contact us on our website at thesefilespod.com or email us directly at sefilespodcast@gmail.com. Thank you so much again for listening, and we hope to catch you next time for another episode of the Strike and Ellicott Files.